Next up, meet the flockers. Birdwatchers in Minnesota are being treated this year to a large flight of great gray owls. That's the good news. The bad news is that they're being driven south by a food shortage. And for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about birds because it's our annual bird show, a year-end tradition here at Science Friday. We'll check in with the director of the Audubon's Christmas Bird Count, heading toward a finish early next week. Maybe you're one of those thousands of volunteer counters spanning the country, tallying the birds at your backyard feeder or your local nature preserve. What kind of birds are you seeing this winter? You know, my bird feeder is not, I found this in researching this and watching over this fall and winter, my bird feeder is not attracting many birds this year. The food stays in the air much, much longer than it had over the summer and fall last year. I wonder why. Maybe we can find out. Well, scientists are compiling years of bird survey data to determine the trends in bird numbers across North America. And this hour, we're going to talk about what they're finding, which birds are most at risk, and why we should care about the plight of birds. If you'd like to join the discussion, tell us about what you're seeing in your backyard. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Jeff LeBaron is the director of the Christmas Bird Count at the National Audubon Society in Williamsburg, Massachusetts. He joins us by phone. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Greg Butcher is the director of bird conservation at the National Audubon Society in Washington, and he joins us by phone from Sandy Point, Maryland. Welcome to the program, Dr. Butcher.
Thanks very much.
Jeff LeBaron, this year's Christmas bird count is well underway. How's it going so far?
Seems to be going very well. I just checked actually online, and at this point there are about 174 counts that have been completely have their data entry finished online. The count started on December 14th, and I know there were some done right on that first day of the count period, and they'll continue through January 5th.
Anything outstanding so far?
It's a little early to tell. As you mentioned, I'm going to be very curious to see how things are sort of developing with this owl movement coming down through the upper Midwest.
What is that? Explain what that is.
There are three species of owls especially that seem to be moving in big numbers this year. It's the great gray owl that you mentioned, also northern hawk owls, and boreal owls. And these birds are probably, as you said, moving in response to a lack of food up in the boreal forests of Canada and the northern United States. So it's one of those things where it's sort of good news for birders, and they always looked forward to these events, but it's not really very good news for the owls because they have to move sometimes thousands of miles out of their normal range, and it can be, actually a lot of them won't make it back to where they should be to breed next year.
So do they migrate as a flock together, or do they just one at a time? Go.
Pretty much one at a time, but at this point, at least since November, in some areas of Minnesota, there have been so many great gray owls around that people can just go out and drive around for an hour or two and see 50 or 60 great gray owls. It's
wow.
An amazing event.
Wow. None have visited my backyard feeder. Jeff, remind us how the count works. You count within a certain geographical circle on a designated day?
Right. Each count is done within a 15-mile diameter circle on one calendar day during the official count period, which is as I mentioned, December 14th through January 5th. And there's groups of people that are organized into parties. It can be anywhere from 5 or 10 people up to hundreds of people that go out and cover the area during that day. And they have specific routes that they take, and they work their way through their areas each day. And once they're done with their area, then they're done for that count. Mm-hmm. There are also another group of people that just use a different methodology where they sit at their homes, as long as their homes are within the count circle, and they count birds that are coming into their feeders.
I got to tell you, I mentioned at the top, I see the number of birds is much lower than I usually remember it to be.
It varies an awful lot from year to year. What it could be is in your area, there's still plenty of wild food crop out available, and the birds aren't actually being forced into the feeders. I know on the counts that I did this year so far, it was sort of mostly nice days, although I got involved with the big snowstorm up here last Sunday at the end of the day. But the two counts I did the weekend before that, it was really pretty pleasant counting conditions. But because of that, the birds were really dispersed, and it was sort of hard to find them.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Greg, tell us about the data that you collect and then what you do with it. Do you make a sort of a national bird count about it?
Absolutely. Basically, the count compilers get all the information from the people in their count circle, and then they get on the Internet, and they enter their data directly onto the Internet, and we add that to a huge computer file. And we now have 104 years of Christmas bird counts totally computerized, and we'll add this year's information over the next month. And then we have a scientist on staff, Dan Niven, who takes all that information and applies an incredible amount of statistical power to it and can tell us population trends, population dynamics, range changes, and all sorts of things about how bird populations change in early winter based on Christmas bird count data.
Can you see an overall trend over the years?
Well, there's no overall trend. Basically, there are some species increasing, some species decreasing, but we do tend to find trends by habitat. And so we find that, for example, grassland birds and shrubland birds aren't doing as well as they did in the past, whereas woodland birds are actually doing okay. Some are going up, some are going down.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Kathleen, is it Penyan, New York?
Yes, it is.
Where is that near?
It's near Rochester.
Ah.
Yeah, sort of between that and Syracuse.
My old stomping grounds.
Really? Oh, how fun for you.
Go ahead.
Anyway, the penguins in the Antarctic on the ice floes are breaking my heart, as do all birds and all the bird problems that Audubon is paying attention to. My question is there anything that can be done about it? Is Audubon paying attention to that problem, and has global warming been cited as one of the perpetrators?
Greg Butcher?
There are some problems like, you know, a huge iceberg that's really too tough for us to really tackle.
Right.
I mean, there's just no way we know to move that amount of ice, and we're fairly sure that the adults will save themselves and come back and breed another year, but I think this year's reproduction is probably not something that we can help, and luckily these are long-lived birds and they'll have other chances to reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
We're very concerned about climate change, about global warming, and it's going to make tremendous differences to our bird populations. And some of them will be okay, and some of them we're going to be very unhappy about. And so I think any effort we can make to combat global climate change is going to be beneficial for both people and birds.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. Have a happy new year.
You too. Thanks.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about the annual Christmas bird count with Jeff LeBaron and Greg Butcher of the National Audubon Society, and we're taking your calls, 1-800-989-8255. I heard a story this week about fewer birds are dying from West Nile virus. They seem to have occurred that these resistant birds are growing in number. Did you hear anything about that?
I haven't kept up on that totally, but we have found a lot of variation from year to year in mortality from West Nile virus, and it seems to be very climate related. So that if the rains come at just the right time and there's a big hatch of mosquitoes, it can be really bad for the birds. Whereas if it's in the Midwest this year, apparently it was too wet in the summertime for the mosquitoes to hatch. And that's the first I'd ever heard of that possibility. Usually you think of drought years as being four mosquito years.
Too wet, that's a lot of rain.
And that was a lot of rain just at the wrong time of year up in Wisconsin especially.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could jump in,
sure.
Also, here in the Northeast, we had also a wet and cool summer, which, as Greg said, there it was just not great for mosquitoes. So I think in some of the areas around here there was less of a mosquito crop and also less West Nile. But it's also true that some of the species, anyway, are starting to build up a bit of a resistance since over the first two or three years, what we were seeing was the first wave of West Nile moving across the country, and now as the survivors are able to breed and hopefully produce surviving offspring, then hopefully there'll be some rebound in numbers.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Tucson, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, nice program.
Thank you.
As they said, in Tucson, Arizona, I live in the city, I've got a golden eagle who's been hanging out on the top of my palm tree. His mate's in the vicinity. We've seen them both, but for the last 3 days, he's been up there every morning for 2 or 3 hours, and pretty cool. We can walk right under him, and I got some great pictures of him. It's pretty neat.
Wow.
That's a pretty cool yard bird.
Yeah, pretty big one, too. We got a lot of hawks around here.
What does he eat?
I don't know. He hasn't been eating anything around here. We got a lot of bunnies, so plenty of food.
Wow. All right. Thanks for calling, Steve.
You bet.
Good luck. 1-800-989-8255. Of course, I think, you know, the two most famous birds are the ones that are here in New York, Pale Male and Lola, who were forced out of their nests, their famous rookery in the high rent district in New York. And then they built them a new one. Jeff, what do you think about that?
I think it's great. They weren't actually quite forced out of their nest. What happened is after the breeding season, the co-op actually took down the old nest. So it wasn't like they were in midstream raising their young or anything. But as you mentioned, there was just a huge hue and cry from the birding community, really across the country. And it's been, you know, every I think it's worked out very well, and it appears that. There will be a new platform and some spikes up there for him to. I guess he's already started reconstructing the nest, and if anything else, I would think it might even add value to the property. So.
Why would they come back? Why wouldn't they just fly away, find a new place? Where have they been in this time?
Well, I'm sure they were around. A pale male tends to stay pretty much around Central Park. His mate or mates over the years, because he's had over the lifetime of one bird, they're pretty much monogamous. But he's had a couple of difficulties with one of his earlier mates, they will always return pretty much to the same territory. And so he stays right around the park for most of the time, and the female. And the offspring also tend to stay around, but the females sometimes tend to disperse a bit more over, like, into New Jersey, not very far. They're just about getting ready to start courtship and everything, and I'm sure he's going to have a pretty good platform up there to keep going for the future.
Yeah, usually the city offers you a great city tax break to stay around, Wall Street companies, whatever. But they got something just as good. Do you know anything about the platform that was designed, anything special on it that would attract them? Or
It's I haven't actually seen the plans, but I was talking, sort of giving some advice about it. And basically the idea was to give him some spikes so that he would have a place to basically vertical spikes on the top of the arch of the window so that he'd have something to start building his platform. And then also have a bit of a structure around it to catch anything that might fall down.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more about birds. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking about the Christmas bird count this hour with my guests, Greg Butcher, Director of Bird Conservation at the National Audubon Society in Washington, and Jeff LeBaron, Director of the Christmas Bird Count at the Audubon Society. On number 1-800-989-8255, let's go to the phones. Ethan in Moscow, Idaho. Hi, Ethan.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Okay, I was wondering how you know you're not recounting the birds when you see them. Because they might go away, then come back, and you don't know if you counted it already?
Good question. Does it matter?
Well, yes, it does. And look, on the Christmas counts, as I mentioned, that people really do have areas and routes that they're going through during the course of the day, so that as they move through their area, they're not returning to that part where they were just counting birds, and they're not going into an area where anybody else has counted. And also, at this time of year, really the birds aren't moving around all that much, at least most of the birds. So the groups, you know, some things like bald eagles or peregrine falcons or flocks of geese or things like that sometimes might move around, but they're more readily identifiable as being the same bird or the same flock of geese or something. And at the end, on Christmas counts, at the end of the day, all of the observers get together and they have a compilation, and actually they can sort of straighten out if somebody saw, you know, a bald eagle flying into the next person's territory, or if they had one fly in from somebody else's. They just make sure that they're not double counting that way. But in terms of the flocks of chickadees and nuthatches and jays and things like that, most of them are relatively sedentary this time of year, so they're not moving around too much.
Ethan, do you count birds? Do you watch birds outside?
Well, we haven't seen very many of the owls here, but, yeah, it is fun to watch the birds.
Do you have a bird feeder?
We did, but we haven't replaced it.
I know. Those squirrels get to them, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know.
There is a Christmas count there in Moscow.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Maybe go out and take a look.
Okay.
Thanks for calling. Happy New Year.
Yep. See ya.
1-800-989-8255. Greg, you just touched a bit on the state of the birds in North America, and you were mentioning that it depends on which areas. I know there's an almost 30% of North America's bird species are in significant decline. Can you break that down, where the endangered ones are and on the ones that aren't?
Yes, as far as we can tell, it depends most on habitats rather than geographical part of the country. And almost throughout the country, it's the birds that nest in the grassland habitats that seem to be doing the worst. And in fact, we've got over 70% of the birds in grassland habitats that are in significant decline. And so we're very anxious to do something to help those species.
Is that because the grassland is going away?
Yeah, pretty much the grassland is kind of the easiest habitat to make a living from for humans. And so we've converted a lot of the grassland to farmland. And then we have a lot of pasture and a lot of haying areas in areas that used to be prairie or other wild grasslands.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's just an awful lot of human economic use of those habitats, and there's just not as much space for birds to live anymore.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Shari in San Jose. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
My husband and I became Audubon members because we put up a small feeder in the yard, and when the word got out, we had to put up several feeders. We now have about two dozen lesser goldfinches. I don't know how many house sparrows, house finches, and jays, etc., and especially the doves, the mourning doves.
Right.
We also now, because they're so fat and happy, now have a family of hawks that like to feed in the yard.
What do they feed on?
They feed on the doves mostly and one or two of the scrub jays.
So you've got your own habitat going back there with all...
We do. And then we've had a couple of guest appearances by warblers and kinglets and such. So it's been very interesting. I even had a nettle woodpecker show up, a female.
Wow.
So...
I have three different kind of woodpeckers in my backyard, in my bird feeder.
Do you?
Yeah.
They're amazing.
Yeah. They love that bird seed, too, you know. They don't care about the grubs that much or whatever, the ants. They go after
They go for the suet or whatever else they can find.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, sounds great. You have your own little nature center back there.
We do, and now we have third-generation squirrels also, which seem to... they like the... slinky on the feeder when we put it on. They thought it was bungee jumping.
Yeah, what a squirrel.
So we got a baffle, and that seems to help a lot. And then we feed them separately around the yard in certain areas. But the Cooper hawks seem to think that this is a wonderful treat, and they're almost in our yard every day.
Wow. Oh, well, that's terrific. Good luck to you, and happy birding.
Thank you, and have a great new year and a healthy one.
Thank you. You too. 1-800-989-8255. Boy, Greg, she could charge admission.
Absolutely. We're really impressed with the power of backyard bird feeding and creating natural backyard habitats to provide, fantastic habitat for birds. And as the country becomes increasingly urbanized and suburbanized, what we do in our backyards is going to make a big difference for how common birds will be in the future.
1-800-989-8255. Bill in Teaneck Peninsula, Alaska. Hi, Bill. Bill, turn your radio down.
This is Janice.
Oh, I'm sorry, Janice. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm just calling from Anchorage, Alaska, to say how much we enjoy the birds this time of year because we have to take our bird feeder down come spring because the bears go after it.
Boy.
I have to do that here in Williamsburg, too.
We have this great feeder. It's right on our kitchen window, and it's suction cupped on, and we just love watching them all through the winter. But one year we waited too long, and when we came down in the morning, there was this sort of brown, muddy paw print streak, and the bird feeder was all crushed, and there were seeds all over the snow.
There's one thing... Thank goodness I don't have to worry about it. We have coyotes in our neighborhood, but the bears aren't there yet, although they are close by in New Jersey. So.
Well, I'm originally from New Jersey, so this has been a pretty fun adventure.
Well, good luck to you. Thank you. And so it's not the suet. They're going right after the seeds itself.
Well, we have suet, and then we also have the seeds up against there. And the bears? Yeah.
Yeah.
They go right after the seeds.
All right. Thanks for calling. Have a happy new year.
All righty. Happy new year.
Bye-bye. 1-800-989-8255. Is it possible, Greg, to attract certain kinds of birds by what you put out in your bird seeder?
Yeah, the birds are very specific, and if you want to get started, the best thing to start with is the black oil sunflower seeds, and,
right.
and most of the birds seem to really go for those. But then the suet brings in the woodpeckers and other birds that don't tend to like the seeds as much. And then the ground feeders tend to like these millet seeds, which are a little less expensive than the black oil sunflower seed. And then finally you can add the thistle seed, also called Niger seed,
mm-hmm.
Which is great for goldfinches and pine siskins and birds like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the more variety of food you provide, the more variety of birds you'll get.
Very interesting.
And it's also important to have a bird bath and a water source that's heated through the winter for them, too.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, because the water can be as important in some areas as the food itself.
Jeff, in general, are these birds you're counting now birds that that winter in the U.S. But return, you know, north to breed?
On the Christmas count, there's sort of two major components to the birds that are the majority of the birds that are counted on CBCs. As you say, they're the ones that are pretty much resident around here that are always in a given region, and also the birds of the boreal forest and the higher latitudes that actually move down into the sort of core of central and southern North America during the Christmas bird count period and through the winter. So. The birds that are the neotropical migrants, the one that go down to the Caribbean and Latin America,
right.
They're pretty much gone by the time the CBC period is in full force. Although those are the birds, you know, if you do get a late one hanging around, that's kind of the catalyst that gets birders out there to count the house finches and house sparrows in the hopes that they're going to find a Cape May warbler or something.
Are you going to find southern birds now moving north because of the climate change?
Well, certainly southern birds have been moving north in the winter season. Tufted titmice, northern cardinals, Carolina wrens, and northern mockingbirds and red-bellied woodpeckers have all really sort of marched northward over the last 50 to 70 years. It could be somewhat due to climate change. It also could just be that there are a lot more bird feeders. Most of those birds are birds that either are readily, you know, come into bird feeders and yards or at least to ornamental plantings and yards, which is kind of what's helped the mockingbirds out.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about birds this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Dan in White Lake, Wisconsin. Hi, welcome, Dan.
Good afternoon. A few comments on this raptor migration from Canada. This is a cyclical thing. There's a professor at the University of Wisconsin by the name of Donald Roush who has many articles published in the Journal of Wildlife Management. It turns out that the snowshoe hares up in the boreal forest actually eat themselves out of house and home. They're so prolific. When they're on the uptick, when their population is on the uptick, the predator population increases significantly, but eventually the snowshoe hares eat so much of the brush and the willow that there's a massive die-off. And up at Duluth, Minnesota, there is a big ridge that runs west off the end of Lake Superior called Hawk Ridge. People go up there, volunteers to count raptors in the fall, and when the hare population in Canada is high, that daily raptor count might be something in the neighborhood of 350 to 500 raptors a day. When the hare population plummets, they can count 4,000 or 5,000 raptors a day. And there's birds, and some of those birds are game birds. And in the Lake States, Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, one of the dominant game birds for people that hunt birds is the ruffed grouse. The ruffed grouse are cyclical, and the ruffed grouse cycle is opposite the snowshoe hare in Canada.
Uh-huh. You know, I'm sure that we haven't got enough time to go through the whole population of Wisconsin, but I appreciate your call, and thanks for calling, and have a happy new year.
Yes, thank you.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. People love to talk about birds. I know when I get started. Susan in Denver, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, I'd like to know if the Christmas count is still going on, and how can I sign up locally? What number can I call in Denver?
The count is still going on. I'm not sure whether the counts in Denver have been done yet. There are at least two CB Christmas bird counts right in the Denver area, as well as several other ones around. On the Christmas bird count website is probably the best place to find out whether those counts have been done yet. It's www.audubon.org/bird/CBC. And on that, you'll see a link that says Get Involved.
Like bird slash what?
CBC, as in Christmas bird count.
Okay.
And you'll see a link that says Get Involved. And when you click on that, you can actually
get a pull-down menu of the states and provinces, and once you select Colorado, it'll tell you the dates of the accounts that haven't been done yet.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Good luck
to you.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Mark in Hebau, Oregon. Hi, Mark.
Hello. We have evening grosbeaks that come here in the summer, and they breed, and we have all their kids and everything, but this year we had a flock of them. They're here now, about 20 of them, and it's disconcerting to see them out here because they usually don't arrive until May, and I'm just wondering if there's sort of a explanation for that. Or
are you feeding them?
Well, we have feeders all year round, and we have the juncos and chickadees, you know, the normal winter feeders here. But this flock of evening grosbeaks showed up, and it's really surprising to see them there.
The evening grosbeaks are what's called an eruptive species, where during the winter and the off-season, they actually sometimes make pretty good movements away from the breeding territory. And while obviously you do have them there as breeders, what you probably have at your feeders now, or in your yard anyway, is a group that came from somewhere else, either further north or up in the mountains or just a little bit different place. These movements of evening grosbeaks actually change year to year to year, exactly where the big numbers are. And sometimes they go down the Rockies, sometimes they head east. It's a fascinating study, and actually you can actually follow where they are on you know, over time with the Christmas counts.
Hmm. Well, we've run out of time. Jeff and Greg, thanks for taking time to join us today.
Thank you.
Jeff LeBaron is director of the Christmas Bird Count at the National Audubon Society, and Greg Butcher is director of bird conservation there at the National Audubon Society in Washington. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick, Paul Masiello, and George Idiart in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Key Molesky, Alphonse Vinn. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have free teaching materials. So click on the teacher button over there. Also, you can download Science Friday on your iPod and audible.com and listen to it on Real Audio. And also, you can get back editions of all the stuff we do on Science Friday. Have a great and safe New Year's holiday weekend. Happy New Year to you all. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.